and the Portuguese would anchor and send away his little dories with a couple of men in them to fish with the cod-line. As a boy, the second mate had been out with his uncle, a blue-nose from Halifax, and he had caught 479 codfish in 11 hours, some of them 50 pounds in weight. As to the fog, it was caused by the cold Labrador current setting south, then rising over the banks and meeting the warm air of the Gulf Stream. The doctor had heard tell of the Gulf Stream, and so brewing up a fog almost continual. Some days you would say the whole sea was steaming like a pot, it brewed so fast, and that was why the wind did not blow it away, it was brewed afresh continual. To be sure, there were some times in the year when the current set more easterly, and there was no fog. It might be clear as clear for days or even weeks, but for all that you always knew where the banks were, even without taking soundings, because of the birds. There were always birds, particular birds, on the banks, thick or clear. "What kind of birds?" asked Stephen. "Murrays, dovekies, guillemots, razorbills, kittiwakes, shearwaters, fulmars, skuas, all sorts of gulls, puffins, penguins." "Penguins, my dear sir," cried Stephen. "That's right, doctor, a very old-fashioned bird that can't fly but only swim. Some call them gairfowl, but we call them penguins. It stands to reason, if a bird can't fly, it is a penguin. Ask any whaler that has been far south." "Does it stand about a yard high, black and white, with a prodigious razor-bill?" "That's the very bird, sir. But it has a white patch between its bill and its eye." Without the shadow of a doubt, this was the Alca impennis of Linnaeus, the great auk of some vulgar authors, a bird Stephen had longed to see all his life, a bird grown so rare that none of his correspondents but Corvisart had ever seen a specimen, and Corvisart was somewhat given to lying. "And have you indeed seen your penguin, sir?" he asked. "God love you, many and many a time," said the young man, laughing. "There is an island up that way," nodding towards Newfoundland, "where they breed by wholesale, and my uncle, the Blue-Nose, used to go there when he was fishing the Grand Bank. I went with him once, and we knocked them on the head by the score. He would have made you laugh to see them standing there like ninepins to be bowled over. We cut them up for bait, and ate the eggs."
"Blue-nosed hellhound," said Stephen inwardly. "Goth, vandal, Hun!"
Aloud, and with as much amenity as he could summon, he asked, "Is there any likelihood of seeing one on this bank?"
"I dare say there is, doctor, if you keep a sharp lookout. Do they interest you? I will lend you my glass."
Stephen kept a sharp lookout, in spite of the cold that misted his telescope and deadened his blue extremities, and by the time the packet glided into the mist on the southern edge of the bank, far, far ahead of the schooners, he had seen not only murrays and dovekies, but two great auks. The mist thickened. The Diligence was completely hidden from her pursuers. Mr. Dalgleish took in his kites, royals, t'gallants, courses, everything but the foretopsail lowered on the cap and a jib, just enough to steer by in that swirling obscurity. Evening came on, and still Stephen stood there, shivering, in the hope of a third. The Diligence ghosted along, her bell tolling continually, with double lookouts fore and aft. Her best bower cleared away and poised a cockbill from her starboard cathead, for as Mr. Dalgleish said, he had no notion of carrying on by night with all these craft about and the danger of summer ice coming down. From far and near came the answering drums or whistles, and on every hand the howl of conches from unseen dories. From white the fog grew grey, and greyer still. The riding lights and stern lantern of a ship showed hazy gold 200 yards away, a ship with a peculiarly thin and piercing whistle, worked by a crank.
"Leviathan ahoy!"
hailed Mr. Dalgleish.
"What ship is that?"
asked Leviathan out of the fog.
"Diligence, of course! William, what's your ground?"
30 fathom!"
Mr. Dalgleish put his helm alee. The packet made a smooth sweep, brought her head to the wind, took on a little sternway, and dropped her anchor.
"Mr. Henry is on the rampage again,"
he remarked in a strong but conversational voice.
"Bugger him!"
said Leviathan, now on the packet's starboard beam.
"How does the cod come in, William?" "Tolerable, tolerable, Jamie," said Leviathan, with a fruity chuckle. "No caplin, but they are taking squid. Send the boat over, and you shall have a bit of fish to your supper."
The boat shoved off with a second mate and came back, laughing as it pulled across the steaming water, with two cod as long as a man and the second mate clasping a very large, very damp, dead, black-and-white bird to his bosom as he came up the side.
"There, Doctor," he said, "they were going to use it for bait, but they have plenty of quid, and I thought it might please you."
Mr. Dalgleish's predictions had been right up until this point, but over their supper of the best codfish in the world, gently poached in a bucket of sea-water, he foretold that Liberty and her consort would give over in the night. Mr. Henry could not afford to stay out day after day with all those men aboard. A mere packet would not answer the outlay. He was not really a blue-water privateer, but an offshore dasher, a snapper-up, and he would now be beating up for Marblehead as fast as he could fly, for the wind would not change until the moon began to wane. Mr. Dalgleish was right about the wind. It hung in the south and west, bearing the diligence cautiously across the middle bank, through hooting Spaniards, Portuguese, Nova Scotians, and Newfoundlanders in the dim daybreak, and the pallid day itself. But he was wrong about Mr. Henry. They were scarcely clear of the mist before the schooners were seen, unmistakable with their raking masts, but fortunately still well to the south.
"Such obstinacy I have never seen!" cried Mr. Dalgleish.
Again he said that the packet might be ballasted with gold, the way they carried on. And again the diligence fled northeast for the Mizenne and the Ottoman banks, under a great press of sail. Yet whatever ruses Dalgleish might conceive, and he thought of many, the devilish Mr. Henry divined them. When they cleared the Mizenne, there he was again, and on the Ottoman, in spite of a night's lying to, the morning showed him stark and clear, within 3 miles. The only thing he could not do was to change the wind. It kept aft, so that the square-rigged diligence had an advantage over the schooners. But it was an advantage that she maintained only by incessant attention to her trim every moment of the endless race. Jibs, stunsails, and kites flashed in and out, and the meagre crew grew more and more exhausted, until Dalgleish determined to shape a course for the Grand Bank itself and its notorious, even thicker fog. And in the long haul eastward for the Grand Bank, the advantage disappeared. With the wind a little abaft the beam, the schooners sailed as fast as the brig, in spite of the sheets hauled iron-tight aft, and the owner at the wheel, trick after trick. They tore along, the three of them, their lee catheads rarely rising from the white racing water, their decks sloping like the roof of a house, the masts complaining, the wind sweeping in over the starboard rail, singing high and loud in the rigging, all tense and taut to the edge of the breaking strain. No fog on the Grand Bank, no refuge there. Birds by the 100,000, bankers by the score, and countless dories hauling in the cod, but no fog. Some freak of the currents left the vast area as clear as the Mediterranean, and the moon was coming to the full. No refuge in the night, either. Mr. Dalgleish cursed the day he had not put into St. John's, Newfoundland, and he put the brig before the wind again, a strong, irregular, gusting wind. As he did so, the foretopmast gave a great, rending creak, and a lengthwise fissure appeared in its upper third. In such an eager chase they could not possibly lie to long enough to send up a spare, so they fished it at once with capstan bars, wringing them tight against the wound with turn after turn of woolding. But a mast so badly sprung could not bear a great press of sail, and their advantage was gone. Now, even directly before the wind, the packet was on no more than equal terms in a light breeze, and when she had to reef her topsails, the schooners gained. So they ran, north and east, more north than east most of the time, through the clear, light blue day and the sparkling night, lit from horizon to horizon by an enormous moon. Jack and Humphreys, and Humphreys' servant, an old marine, had long since attended to the packet's guns and small arms, and they had put what few hands could be spared from the arduous driving of the brig through the great gun exercise. But Jack had no illusions about the diligence's armament. With these poor little inaccurate short-range carronades, her bark would be worse than her bite. And although the hands were good, willing men, they were quite untrained, and very few in number. On Thursday night the breeze dropped almost to a calm, and from the dropping glass, the clouds astern, and the much greater swell, there was a strong probability that the wind would veer into the west, if not well to the north of west, and blow very, very much harder. In the uncertain airs they caught the smell of ice, and towards the end of the first watch, when the moon was near its height, they saw a towering mountain, undermined by the warmer current, overturned completely, sending vast blocks flying into the sea, so that the spray flew high, 100 feet and more, flashing in the moonlight. And some seconds later they heard the long, deep, thunderous crash, infinitely solemn and portentous. On the banks, the Diligence had shipped ice fenders, spars over the bows to deaden the shock of drifting ice, but they also deadened her fine point of speed, and since the springing of the mast they had been taken in, the more so as she was now out of the ordinary track of summer ice. "Unnatural," was Mr. Dalgleish's only comment, as he ordered them to be shipped again. A necessary move, though possibly fatal from the point of view of capture, since any of these jagged blocks, almost entirely beneath the surface, scarcely to be seen, could pierce through a ship's bows even if she were only running at 5 knots, let alone the breakneck 14 2 fathoms the packet had attained. And there were at least 3 more icebergs in their field of vision, gleaming to northwards. Dalgleish had scarcely left the deck since the full, hard chase began. He was unshaved. He looked very old and very tired, and now, with the prospect of a wind that must favour the privateers, he seemed almost crushed. But there was a fine gleam in his red-rimmed eye on Friday morning, when a sail appeared in the east, a blazing golden east, with the high nimbus blushing flamingo red, and every promise of a hearty blow. Stiffly he climbed to the cross-trees with his telescope, and when he came down he said to Jack, "It sounds wicked to see so, but I believe she may be our salvation. Take my spyglass aloft, sir, and see if you think the same." Jack mounted to the masthead like a boy, a heavy boy, and from there, since the rising sun made it difficult to see the stranger, he first studied the Liberty and her companion, the one a little abaft the beam and the other on the packet's quarter. They had come up during the night, and although they were still far beyond the extreme range of long gunshot, they had already felt the first gusts from the northwest that came up with the sun. They knew what o'clock it was, and both had cleared away their bow chasers. As far as he could judge, Mr. Henry's was a long brass 9-pounder, and a very deadly weapon that could be in good hands. Then he turned to the stranger, now clear of the blinding glare. She was a ship, close-hauled on the starboard tack. She was deep-laden, fat-bellied, certainly a merchantman of considerable size and value, and at this stage of the war certainly a British ship. And in her leisurely, comfortable way, under courses and reefed topsails, she was steering a course that would lead her straight into the jaws of the privateers. They had only to shift their helms a little, and they would take her on either side, board her, and carry her before she was awake. But they would have to change course quite soon. On her present tack, and with the strengthening, veering breeze, the merchantmen would be to windward of them before long, and then, however close they could lie, they would surely lose her. Those on board the packet watched with the closest attention. 3 bells. 4 bells. Not a telescope but what was trained on the Liberty to catch the first sign of her bearing up for the merchantman. In the clear light they could see her people, Mr. Henry among them, no doubt, lining the starboard rail, it was black with men, and staring out at the stranger, the answer to a privateer's most fervent prayer. She, for her part, seemed still asleep. She stood on and on, as though into an empty sea. Jack had often seen an indifferent lookout kept in merchantmen, but never anything to equal this.
"Give her a gun," he said in strong indignation. "With your permission, sir, I will give her a gun." "Give her a dozen if you like, Captain Aubrey," said Dalgleish with a bitter laugh. "But believe me, she's in no danger. Mr. Henry doesn't mean to touch her."
Jack gave her 2, happy to warm the carronades. He was almost sure that Dalgleish was right. So fine a seaman, so keen a privateer as Mr. Henry would never have let those precious miles go by, glass after glass, not with such a prize in view. No, he preferred the packet to the merchantman, and presently the guns would be used in earnest. At the first report, Stephen ran up on deck. The situation was clear enough to the most unskilful eye, with the schooners manoeuvring like racing yachts in the veering breeze, and in any case the first mate made it plain in one coarse phrase. After the second gun, he stepped across to Jack and said, "What may I do?"
"Go down to the magazine and fill powder with Mr. Hope," said Jack, "and then you can fight this carronade with me."
Some minutes passed. The merchantman woke up, replied with a single gun, displayed her colours, lowered them in salutation, and hoisted them again. The privateers at once replied with a leeward gun apiece and showed British colours. Jack gave her the remaining carronades off the starboard broadside. Surely that must make them see that something was amiss. The well-remembered powder smell eddied about the deck. The stumpy guns ran smoothly in and out. Their breechings gave a comfortable twang. He and his mates reloaded with grape and round shot. The merchantman shook the reefs out of her topsails and stood on, as into the bosom of her friends. The diligence had early thrown out a signal warning her of her danger, but she seemed to make nothing of it, and in fact she was in no danger at all. The privateers might look wishfully at her, but it was now certain that the packet was their quarry, the packet alone. They had hauled their wind, and they were forereaching on the diligence, diverging from the stranger's course. The crucial moment had almost passed, and presently the stranger would cross their wake into safety.
"Never see die," said Dalgleish, with a ghastly smile.
He gave orders for t'gallants and royals in spite of the wounded mast, and took the wheel himself, luffing up as close as ever she would lie, and then easing off a trifle. He loved the diligence, and he knew her through and through. He called for all that she could give, and she answered superbly. But once the breeze had steadied and the chase had settled down to this new phase, it was apparent that she could not possibly outsail the schooners on the wind. Nor could she put before it now, since the change had set the privateers to leeward before ever they left the merchantman. They were coming up hand over fist, making a good 7 knots to the packet's 6, and by about noon the chase must end in a trial of force. The mails had already been brought on deck, and there they lay, 3 long, thin leather portmanteaux, each lashed to 2 pigs of iron so that they would sink when they were heaved overboard at the last moment. Hour after hour they ran over the grey, heaving sea. Heavy cloud gathered in the west, obscuring the whole horizon. Both swell and wind increased, and many a time the hands glanced up at the fished topmast. In spite of the strong woolding, they saw the hideous cleft gape and close on the heavier rolls. The boatswain clapped on more bands, but even so Dalgleish could not tack against a head sea to get more to windward of the schooners, not with a mast so wounded, and Waring would deliver him right into their hands.
"I will leave the Glorious Aid to you, sir,"
he said to Jack, his eye fixed on the main topsail's weather-leech.
"Once they open fire, I mean to bear up sharp and steer between them."
There was a savage look on his grey, lined, hairy face as he added,
"We will touch them up handsome if it's the last thing we do."
Jack nodded. It was the only course open to them short of striking, and although the probability of success in broad daylight was almost infinitely remote, it was better than a tame surrender. Anything was better than that. Methodically, he and Humphreys and their small party cast loose the carronades on the larboard side, fired them off, and reloaded. Jack loved a clean, heated gun with fresh powder in it. He fired the last, and as it leapt in on the recoil, a great howling roar from aft made him jerk around. Men were capering about the deck, clawing one another on the back, bawling and cheering. Someone let go the main course bowline with a run. The diligence paid off, and the Liberty appeared broad on the beam. Her foremast was gone, broken off short at the partners, and together with its vast spread of sail it was lying over her starboard bow. As he looked, her main topmast followed it, and the schooner shot up into the wind, her slack mainsail beating madly. But here was Dalgleish's furious voice, damning them all for lubbers, roaring,
"Royal halyards, royal halyards, let fly! Tom and Joe round in those fucking weather braces! Clue up there, Ford! Bunt lines, you pox set of horse and swords! Start them, Mr. Harvey, kick the buggers! Ooh, you, Joe, will you start that bloody sheet before I break your head?"
A wild turmoil, in which Jack received 2 kicks and 1 blow from a rope's end, the first since his voice had broken, and the diligence was under plain sail, the strain on her wounded mast reduced, order restored. Mr. Dalgleish handed over the wheel, and he and Jack inspected the Liberty at their leisure. She had run straight onto ice with all her force, impaling herself and, since she was already very much by the head, apparently shearing away her stem below the waterline. Her people were trying to get her boats over the side, and the other schooner was standing towards her, directly away from the packet, losing an hour's gain in 5 minutes. After another board northwards, the packet put before the wind, and the schooners dropped astern.
"Will the single vessel continue to pursue us, do you think?" asked Stephen.
"No, sir," said Dalgleish, yawning. "You can go to your cot and sleep easy. I am sure I shall. She will cram all Mr. Henry's men aboard, if she possibly can. Look at the vast number of them going across, for God's sake. There is a silly bugger has thrown himself into the sea. Ha, ha, ha! It is as good as a play. Then she will go home, and a weary time they will have of it, beating to the eastward day and night. They will be eating their belts and their shoes before they see Marblehead again, with all those hands aboard and no stores saved out of the Liberty."
"There is something in the misfortunes of others that does not altogether displease us," said Stephen.
But nobody heard him in the general cry of, "There she goes!" as the now distant Liberty slipped beneath the grey surface of the ocean.
"No, sir," said Mr. Dalgleish again. "You can sleep easy now, and so can Mrs. So can your betrothed, your Financy. I forget the lady's name. I hope she has not been disturbed by all the banging and calling out."
"I doubt it," said Stephen, "but I will go down and see."
He was mistaken. Diana was very much disturbed indeed. The first discharge of artillery had wiped out her already waning seasickness. She had misinterpreted the later gunfire and the uproar on deck, and Stephen found her dressed, sitting on a locker, with a cocked pistol in either hand, looking as fierce as a wild cat in a trap.
"Put those pistols down at once," he said coldly. "Do not you know it is very rude to point a pistol at a person you do not mean to kill? For shame, Villiers! Where were you brought up?"
"I beg your pardon," she said, quite daunted by his severity. "I thought there was an action, that they had boarded."
"Not at all, not at all. The most inveterate privateer, the Liberty, has undone herself entirely. She ran upon ice and sank not 5 minutes since, and the other, loaded like Noah's Ark, is going home. Give you joy of your escape, my dear. You are looking better, I find," he said, taking her pulse. "Yes, you are far better. Should you like to take some fresh air and see the discomfiture of our enemies?"
Stephen led her on deck, a deck still full of wild hilarity, no sense of hierarchy at all, and her appearance was greeted with a spontaneous, friendly cheer. Busy hands supported her to the rail, pointed out the distant schooner now standing west. Tight against her elbow, the cook gave her a detailed account of the movements since sunrise in a hoarse whisper, almost drowned by the explanations of the two mates and a little stunted boy who wished her to know that he had foreseen it all from the start. Mr. Dalgleish came up, took off his hat, and welcomed her with some ceremony.
"We are all very happy to see you on deck, ma'am," he said, "and hope we may be so honoured every day for the rest of the passage when fine. Not that there will be so many days if this wind holds true. Those villains pushed us east so fast and far, I should not be surprised to raise Rockall on Wednesday."
And seeing that Rockall meant nothing to her, he said,
"I should not be surprised if we were to make the quickest passage ever known, bar Clytie's in 94. And how glad they will be to see us, ma'am, with the news we bring. I fairly laughed aloud when first I heard the Shannon had took the Chesapeake."
Chapter 4. Having sent up the new topmast at last, the Diligence headed south and west with as fair and sweet a breeze as a sailor could pray for. It came in over her starboard quarter, often bringing rain, but always steady and strong, as constant as the trades day after day. And although strictly it was a t'gallant breeze, Mr. Dalgleish spread his royals as well at the least slackening, for he was determined not to lose a yard of its thrust. In spite of their lying to on the banks, there was every likelihood of their making an extraordinarily rapid passage, the privateers having pushed them eastwards so fast and far. He was perfectly convinced that the Diligence must be a very great way ahead of the dull-sailing Nova Scotia on her southern route, that they would be the first home, and like every soul aboard, he was bursting to tell the news. The wind held true. Dalgleish cracked on. The packet logged 269 sea-miles from one noon to the next. On the 17th day out of Halifax they struck soundings, and in the chops of the channel he told his news to a homeward-bound Guineaman, bawling, "Shannon has taken Chesapeake!" through the driving western rain as he passed to windward, leaving her cheering like a ship of fools. He told it to a Cornish pilchard boat and a pilot cutter off the Dodman, to a frigate near the Eddiston, and to some others, mostly outward bound. By all sound reasoning, the news, if it had reached England at all, should have been confined to the southwestern tip of that damp island, and in any case the diligence racing up the channel with a screeching southwester and a following tide for the last stretch to Portsmouth should certainly have outpaced it. But not at all. She was standing in with the signals for dispatches flying, Haslar on her larboard bow, South Sea Castle on her starboard beam, when the Admiral's barge, double-banked and pulling hard, came out to meet her.
"Is it true?" cried the flag lieutenant.
"Yes, it is," answered Humphreys, one foot already on the quarter-ladder, the dispatch buttoned into his bosom. The barge rounded to. He made a spring, lost his hat in the breeze, landed a sprawl, and was borne off laughing to the post-chaise and four that was to whirl him up to the Admiralty at 10 miles an hour. A post-chaise hastily adorned with oak branches, laurel having been in short supply since the beginning of the American War, for want of demand. Yet even now that the news was public, the packet did not moor in any atmosphere of anticlimax. The rumour's confirmation rather served to heighten the excitement, to strengthen the furious desire to know every detail. The passengers had to endure the eager questioning, though not the inspection, of the customs officers, and when at last they came ashore they were surrounded by people who begged to be told how, where, and when. The streets were crowded, work was at a stand, with all Portsmouth hurrying out of doors, and on the common hard liberty men and dockyard mateys were already piling up the material for an enormous bonfire. Shopkeepers and their apprentices pushed through the mob to add crates, barrels, and strange offerings such as a three-legged sofa and a one-wheeled gig to the heap. There was cheering in every public house. It was as though Portsmouth had just heard the news of a great fleet action, a victorious fleet action. It was, of course, a measure of the country's profound dismay, of its painful astonishment, frustration, and resentment at the series of defeats inflicted by the Americans, and perhaps of its love for the Royal Navy. Yet even so, Jack found it somewhat excessive. For one thing, it delayed him in the tedious round of formalities that he had to make before he was his own master. He was all alive with a lover's desire to see his wife. He longed to be in his own house and to see his children and his horses, and these obstacles brought a superficial annoyance over his deep happiness. The spirit of contradiction formed no great part of his character, but what there was of it came to life as he shouldered his way along to the Port Admiral's office. The sailors might bawl and roar as much as ever they pleased. They knew what such a battle meant. But the triumphant civilians did not please him, nor did their shouting about the "Yankees, we'll thump them again and again!" As he passed the blue posts, a band of excited girls obliged him to step into the gutter, and there he found himself face to face with a pawnbroker by the name of Abbs, a greasy acquaintance from very early days, when first Mr. Midshipman Aubrey had anything worth pawning. Abbs had scarcely changed. Still the same pendulous cheeks like ill-shaved bath chaps, still the same bulbous nose, and now both cheeks and nose had an unnatural purple flush. He recognised his old customer at once and cried,
"Captain, have you heard the news? The Shannon has taken the Chesapeake!"
They were borne past one another, but Jack still heard him call out,
"We'll thump them again and again!"
By the time he came out of the office, having reported himself and having recounted the action in detail for the 100th time, the bonfire was blazing high, and the general din of rejoicing had grown louder still.
"I did not mind the hullabaloo in Halifax," he reflected. "Indeed I enjoyed it. I thought it natural, right and proper. But then they were on the spot. They suffered from the Americans. Their ships were taken, and they actually saw the Shannon and the Chesapeake."
It also occurred to him that when first he went ashore in Halifax he had not missed his dinner. Now, in the extreme excitement of reaching land, of telling the glorious news, and of seeing his sweetheart again, a Gosport woman, the packet's cook had completely lost his head. There had been no dinner, and Jack's empty stomach cleaved to his backbone. The case was altered. He made his way across the road to the Crown and called for bread and cheese and a quart of beer.
"And hearty," he said to the waiter, "send a sharp boy round to Davis's for a horse, a weight-carrying horse. He is to say it is for Captain Aubrey, and if he is here before I have finished my beer he shall have half a crown. There is not a moment to lose."
No common boy could have earned the half-crown, the crowd being so thick and Captain Aubrey's thirst for beer so great, his first honest English stingo for a long, long while, but the Crown's boy, fed on heel taps and nips of gin and what he could pick up, was preternaturally sharp, though wizened. He brought Davis's big mare by back ways, leapt the gate into Parker's Close, and the other gate out of it at infinite peril, left the huge, snorting beast staring in the stable-yard, and walked casually in to announce its presence, just as Jack raised his tankard for the last time.
"You will excuse me, gentlemen," said Jack to the group of officers who had already gathered round him. "I have dispatches for home, and must not linger."
Davis's mare had carried a good many heavy sea officers in a hurry. The task had aged her before her time, spoiling her temper entirely, but none so heavy nor so urgent as Captain Aubrey. And by the time they had climbed Portsdown Hill, she was thoroughly discontented. Her ears were braced hard aft, there was a nasty look in her eye, and she was sweating profusely. He paused for a moment to let her draw breath while he admired the telegraph, its arms whirling 20 to the dozen, no doubt sending further details of the victory along the chain to London. The mare chose this moment to get rid of him by a surprisingly nimble caper in a creature of her size, a frisk, a twist, and a lively imitation of the rocking horse. But although Jack was not an elegant horseman, he was a determined one. The enormous pressure of his knees drove most of the breath and some of the wickedness out of her. Her iron mouth yielded to his ever stronger heave. She returned to her duty, and he rode her hard over the green down. Then, turning right-handed from the high road, he galloped her along grassy lanes, the shortcuts he knew so well, up hill and down dale, until on the last rise he came to his own land, his own plantations. How the trees had shot up! And on through Delderwood, that lovely copse, on by Kimber's new road, where the mare nearly stumbled, on, holding her hard, past raw mine workings, a tall, gaunt chimney, stark buildings, all uninhabited. But he had no eyes for them as he flew along, guiding his horse as instinctively as he would have steered a cutter through an intricate tideway. For there, through a gap in the trees, was the roof of his house, and his heart was pounding like a boy's. He had approached Ashgrove Cottage from the back, the quickest way, and now he rode into the broad stable-yard, unfinished when he had left it, but now already quite mature, established, and even elegant with its clock-tower over the coach-house, its rosy brick, its rows of whitewashed boxes, and its archway leading into the garden. As he reined in, a quick glance all round showed the same pleasant mellowing on every hand. The new wings, the reward of a successful campaign in the Mascarenes, and the recapture of several East Indiamen, that had transformed the cottage into a fair-sized country house, now merged with the older building. The creepers that he had planted as miserable, straggling wisps now made a brave show above the lower windows, and his apples topped the orchard wall. Yet everything was as still and silent as a dream. No horses' heads peered out of the half-doors. In any case, the half-doors were all shut, and no groom, no living soul moved about the spotless yard, nor yet behind the shining windows of the house. Not a sound but for a distant cuckoo, changing his tune far beyond the apple-trees. For a moment the strange premonition checked his joy, a hint of another world in which he did not belong. But then the stable-clock gave a click and a whir as it prepared to strike the quarter. There was life here, and he was sitting on a horse in a muck-sweat that must be looked to at once. He raised his voice and hailed the house.
"Ahoy there!"
The echo came back from Delderwood.
"Ahoy there!"
Faint but clear. Again the strangest pause, as though either he or this visible world were an illusion. His look of excitement and happiness faded, and he was just about to dismount, when two little girls, with a small fat boy between them, marched past the archway in file, carrying flags and crying,
"Wilkes and Liberty! Huzzay, huzzay! Right wheel! Huzzah, huzzah!"
They were long-legged girls with ringlets, quite remarkably pretty. But Jack's loving eye could still make out traces of the turnip-faced, sparse-haired, stumpy little creatures he had left, his twin daughters. They were still remarkably alike, but the slightly taller one, the leader, was almost certainly Charlotte. And in all likelihood the fat boy was his son George, last seen as a pink baby, much the same as all others. His heart gave him a most unaccustomed ring, and he called out,
"Hey there!"
It was an entirely one-sided wave of affection, however. Charlotte only glanced round and cried,
"Come back tomorrow. They're all gone to Pompey."
And continued her pompous, fanatical march, followed by the others, all chanting, "Wilkes and Liberty!" He slipped from his horse and tried several boxes, all of them swept clean, scrubbed and bare, until he found one in use. There he unsaddled the mare, rubbed her down, and covered her with a rug. The clock struck the quarter, and he walked across the yard into the house through the kitchen door, through the empty kitchen with its gleaming copper pans, and into the white corridor beyond. In the silence, the clean, light-filled silence, he hardly liked to call, although the house was so familiar, so intimately well-known that his hand found the doorknobs of itself. He was not an imaginative man, yet it was as though he had returned from the dead only to find still, sunlit death waiting for him. He looked into the dining room. Silence there, no more. The breakfast room. Neatness, clarity, no sound, no movement at all. Automatically his eye glanced at the regulator, the austere clock by which he checked his astronomical observations. It had stopped. His own room, and there was Sophie, sitting at his desk, with a sea of papers in front of her, and in the second before she looked up from her sum, he saw that her face was sad, worried, thinner than before. Radiant joy, a delight as great as his own, innumerable questions almost all unanswered, incoherent fragmentary accounts on either side, interrupted by kisses, exclamations, enraptured or amazed. "And is it true?" she cried as she led him into the kitchen, for somehow it had become apparent that he had not dined.
"Oh, Jack, I'm so glad to have you home."
"Is what true, sweetheart?"
said he, sitting at the white-scrubbed table and looking eagerly at the ham.
"That the Shannon took the Chesapeake. There was a rumour this morning. The postman stopped to repeat it, and Bondon and Killick begged to go to Portsmouth, so I let them take the cart with the others. I wonder they're not back yet. They've been gone for hours."
"Yes, perfectly true, thank God. That is what I was trying to tell you. Stephen and Diana and I were aboard, as neat an action as you could wish, 15 minutes from the first gun to the last, and we all came home in the packet together. Such a passage, once we had got rid of the privateers. Is there any more bread, my love?"
"Dear Stephen," cried Sophie, "how is he? Why is he not here? Do eat some more ham, my darling. You are dreadfully thin. I am so sorry there was none of the pasty left. The children ate it up for supper. Where is he?"
"He is still in Portsmouth, but he is to post up to town tomorrow, and he may look in. There was some difficulty about Diana, about her nationality, and she is not to move until they hear from the Secretary of State's office. She is staying with the Fortescues, and Fortescue, Stephen, and I have gone bail in $5,000 apiece that she don't wander off. Not that she will. She and Stephen are to be married at last."
"Married?" cried Sophie.
"Yes, I was astonished, too. The first I heard of it was when he asked Philip Broke to perform the ceremony. A captain can marry people, you know, aboard his own ship. And although Broke could not very well do so that day, seeing that Chesapeake was standing out of Nantasket Roads, I know he would have done so after the action. If he had not been so badly wounded, he could not even write his own dispatch. Yes, they are to be married, and perhaps it is all for the best. He has longed for her these many, many years, and certainly she behaved very well during our escape, and then after the action. A rare Plucton, upon my word. Diana has never wanted for spirit, and I shall always be grateful to her for having sent you news of the Leopard."
"So shall I," said Sophie, "and I shall call on her first thing tomorrow. Dear Diana, how I hope they will be happy."
She spoke with real feeling, and if Jack had reflected, he would have applauded her heart's victory over what might be called her moral judgment, or perhaps her principles. Sophie belonged to a quiet, staid, provincial family, untouched by scandal of an amorous nature as far as it could trace its origins, a family that had been rigidly Puritan in Cromwell's time, and that even now regarded the least irregularity with extreme abhorrence. In spite of her mother's upbringing, she was too kind and too good-natured to be a prude, but on the other hand, she had not the least intuitive understanding or sympathy for those who strayed onto the wilder shores of love. In its physical aspects, even the domesticated strand was of no great interest to her, and Diana's irregularities had not been of the least, far from it. They had excited comment even in the very liberal society of London, where she had maintained a certain position only by her beauty, her spirit, and the friendship of some of the Prince of Wales's circle. But Jack did not reflect. His mind, in its delightful whirl, had caught up on the mention of Bondon, his former coxswain, and of Killick, his steward. He said,
"How in God's... How on earth did Bondon and Killick come here?
Captain Kerr sent them with a very polite note. He said since he was to have a caster instead of you, it was but fair you should have your own people for your next command.
That was handsome in Robert Kerr, upon my word. Very handsome indeed. My next command. Ha, ha, Sophie. I tell you what, before I go to sea again, I shall fill the house with clocks. There is no life in a room without there is a clock ticking away in it. There are some that go a 12-month without winding.
Your next command, began Sophie. But she knew she must not go on to wish that he might never have a next command, that he might never, never go away from home again, nor be exposed to storms, battles, shipwrecks, or imprisonment. She knew that an implied condition of their marriage was that she should sit there waiting while he was exposed to all these things. So she ended,
"But I hope, dear Jack, that the clocks will not have to go a year, not a whole year. I am so sorry about the regulator. Charlotte's Dormouse got into it and is having babies."
"Oh, as for a ship," said Jack, "I'm in no great hurry unless they offer me Belvedere or Egyptienne on the North American station. What I hope for is one of the new 24-pounder frigates now building, and I do not think it would be asking too much. After all, it is not every day a fourth-rate sinks a 74. That will give me some months ashore, seeing that she is ordered just to my liking and dealing with things at home."
A cloud came over their happiness, for things at home must necessarily include the wretched Mr. Kimber. They understood one another perfectly, however. Kimber might mean endless complications and perhaps very heavy financial loss, but for the present Charlotte's Dormouse was more important by far. He went on,
"Yet my time in frigates is pretty well over. A ship of the line is much more likely, and I shall be in no hurry for that."
There was so much to say, so many crossed letters to disentangle, such news of the jasmine and the wonderful success of the espaliered apricot tree, that after a while they lapsed into a delighted silence, holding hands over the kitchen table like a pair of simpletons, looking at one another with infinite pleasure. Through this silence came the sounds of Wilkes and Liberty, often repeated and coming nearer.
"That is the children," said Sophie.
"Yes," said Jack. "I saw them marching about like thrones and dominions. But what are they at?"
"They are playing Westminster elections. Your father is standing."
She hesitated for a moment and added apologetically,
"In the radical interest."
"Good God!" cried Jack.
General Aubrey's snipe-like political career, now seeking to expose corruption, now to participate in it, had often carried him into opposition to government, but never so far as this. Ever since the general had first been returned for the rotten borough of Gripe, the property of a friend, he had contrived to be a Tory when the first lord of the Admiralty was a Whig, and some one of the many varieties of Whig when the first lord was a Tory. The general, a man of demoniac energy that increased with age, with an unquenchable flow of soldierly, unpolished eloquence in the House, had been a thorn in the ministry's side as an opponent and a cruel embarrassment as a supporter. His occasional efforts at helping his son by political influence had always been ill-judged, and sometimes nearly disastrous. It is true that the general rarely thought of him, but even so Jack would have reached post rank far earlier if it had not been for his father.
"Shall I call them in?" asked Sophie.
"Yes, do, my dear," said Jack. "I should like to make George's acquaintance."
"Children," called Sophie, dreading a want of recognition, "come in and bid your father welcome home. He has come back from America."
For all her precautions, they stared at him without the least knowledge and looked about the room for some other, more recognizable man. For a moment it was exquisitely painful, but then they remembered their manners, advanced gravely side by side, curtsied, and said,
"Good afternoon, sir. Welcome home,"
with a quick glance at their mother to see if that were adequate.
"George," she murmured, "where is your leg?"
The little boy blushed and hung his head, but, gathering his courage, he came forward from the door, made a jerky bow, and, holding out his hand, said,
"I hope I see you well, sir." "Welcome home," whispered his sisters. "Welcome home," said George, staring with all his might, and then, with no transition, "They will be here directly. I heard the cart in the lane. If the news is true, Bondon has promised to bring me an iron hoop. And iron hoop, sir."
"I dare say you will get it, George,"
said his father, smiling. Charlotte, feeling that the silence which followed might be painful, said politely,
"Grandpapa was here the other day with Sir Francis Burdett.
and he explained to us about the Westminster election and Wilkes and Liberty. We have been voting for him ever since. Don't you wish he may get in?"
"Children, children," said Sophie, "you must change your shoes and wash your hands and faces. Fanny and Charlotte, put on clean pinafores. We are going to sit in the drawing-room."
"Yes, Mamma,"
they cried. But at this moment the cart could be heard coming into the stable-yard, and they rushed out in a body. A few seconds later they rushed back, cried,
"It's true! There's been a famous victory! Shannon has taken Chesapeake! Huzzay! Huzzay!"
and vanished. They could be heard shouting barbarously, their piercing voices high above the men's deep rumble, and Jack noticed that in the yard they used the broad accent and the broader expressions of the lower deck. Fanny referred to Bondon as a goddamn swab, but cheerfully, without the least injurious intent, and Charlotte was heard to say that,
"Although Wurlitch was as drunk as David's sow, any crew of grass-combing B, blank S, could have harnessed the pony better than that."
True enough. Of the four men that made up the household at Ashgrove Cottage, three had been bred to the sea from childhood. They knew nothing of horses. And although the fourth, the weak-headed Wurlitch, had been a farmer's boy before the press gang caught him 20 years ago, he was lying speechless in the bottom of the cart, incapable of moving a finger since before they started back. The others, faced with the mute, immobile, paralytic Wurlitch, and the loss of the collar, had seized the pony to the shafts in a most seaman-like manner. There was not the least possibility of its coming adrift. But since the running bowline round the creature's neck choked it every time it advanced, they had been obliged to push the cart all the way from the Hand and Racket, where they had celebrated the victory. However, the exercise had sweated them sober, or at least sober enough to meet the not very exacting naval standards. And when Bondon, the strongest head of all, reported to the drawing-room for orders, his happiness owed little to dog's nose, flip, or raspberry shrub. He gave his captain joy of his return and joy of the victory, and listened with keen attention to Jack's account of the battle, following every move with total understanding.
"If it had not been for poor Captain Broke," he said, "it would have been perfect. I served under him in the old Druid, and he was a rare one for the great guns even then. Will he recover, sir?"
"I hope so, Bondon, I'm sure,"
said Jack, shaking his head at the recollection of that shocking wound.
"But the doctor will be able to tell you better than I can. He may look in tomorrow, so let his room be prettied to the nines in case he stays, and then just step round to Mr. Kimber with my compliments, and I should be glad to see him early in the morning before I set off."
"Aye, aye, sir," said Bondon. "The doctor's room it is, and Mr. Kimber to report immediately after breakfast."
"Before you set off, my dear?"
cried Sophie, the moment the door had closed behind him.
"But surely you do not have to go to the Admiralty at once? Surely the Admiral gave you leave?"
"Oh, yes, he was most obliging, did everything that was proper, and he sent you his love. No, it is not the Admiralty I am worrying about, it is Louisa Broke. She must be told how her husband is as soon as possible, and if I travel up early tomorrow, I can take the Harwich flyer there and back and be home on Friday."
"A letter, an express letter, would do just as well. You are so tired, dear Jack, and as thin as a rail. You must have some rest, and 24 hours in a stagecoach would quite knock you up, to say nothing of the ride to town. And anyhow, as you told Bond, and you cannot say anything about poor Broke's wound, an express letter with every sort of good wish and comfort and Stephen's opinion, that would be far better in every way."
"Sophie, Sophie,"
he said, smiling at her. In her heart she was obliged to admit that in the service it was usual for men to travel great distances to comfort their shipmates' families, and that several times she had been most infinitely relieved by such kindness. Only a few months ago the first lieutenant of the Java had come from Plymouth to assure her that she still possessed a husband. But even so she could not help rebelling against this sudden flying off. She muttered, "Louisa Broke," in a discontented, somewhat jealous tone, and several fresh reasons occurred to her. She did not utter them, however, for there was something in Jack's eye, the set of his head, that convinced her they would be useless, however sound, and presently their perfect happiness came back. They wandered into the garden to look at particularly valuable plants, above all those nearest the original cottage, those they had planted themselves. Neither had much genius in that line, nor indeed much taste, and the survivors, a small proportion, stood about in stark, unrelated clumps. But these flowers, such as they were peculiarly their own, and they loved them dearly. When she had to go in to attend to the children, he went in with her, and she heard his strong, familiar step as he moved about the house.
Presently he reached the music room, and her piano, rarely used but fortunately retuned for the girl's lessons, gave out a great series of crashing chords, rising and rising with a splendid gaiety before they dropped to a deep, meditative thunder that merged quietly into a Hummel sonata that Jack often played and that she herself had learnt long ago. Then he took his fiddle, a fiddle far above his station, an Amati no less, bought from the spoils of the Indian Ocean, and played the same piece again, transposed for the violin. He did not play well. It was long since he had had a fiddle in his hands, and in any case the fingers of his injured arm had not yet recovered all their nimbleness. But it would have been all one to Sophie if he had been Paganini. The house was alive again. It was fully inhabited. She had been right about Jack's immovable determination, however. He and Stephen stepped into their post-chaise immediately after dinner next day, and bowled away as fast as four horses would draw them, lurching and rumbling over the side road from Ashgrove Cottage.
"I should not really be travelling in this style," observed Jack, when they reached the highway and conversation was possible again. "The common coach is more my line, or even the wagon."
"You refer to Kimber, I make no doubt," said Stephen.
"Not exactly. Kimber did not choose to come. He was just leaving for Birmingham, he said. But he sent a gang of what he called new associates in our venture, and rum cullies they were, some of them, a couple of little attorneys in dirty neckcloths who kept taking notes."
"Tell me, brother, are things very bad?"
"Well, the only thing that is clear is that Kimber has exceeded my instructions 1,000 times over, with enormous workings, deep shaft mining, and all sorts of machinery, and the association, as they call it, has taken interests in other concerns, including a navigation canal."
"The canal alone was wanting," said Stephen to himself. "Now, apart from perpetual motion and the philosopher's stone, the picture is complete."
"And it is an odd thing," continued Jack. "On the one hand, they say the losses and the debts are enormous. One fellow showed me a sum that was roughly twice what I possess, though he admitted it was only an estimate. And on the other, they urge me to press on. Dig just a little deeper, they say, and turn a dead loss into a princely fortune. But in either case, they want fresh money or fresh security. And I saw one of the attorney coves, looking round the room, pricing the furniture. You would have admired me, Stephen. I was as cool as a judge, and I let them talk. They were importunate to know my holdings in government stock. Asked me straight out, goddamn their impertinence, and the nature of my marriage settlements, and what was Sophie's fortune, and what was my father's estate. That was coming it a little high. They must have thought they had a fine pigeon to pluck, a fellow that had no notion of business, and that could be persuaded or frightened into any kind of ruinous foolishness. But I cut them short, said I did not mean to put down another penny, and wished them good day. Lord Stephen, there are advantages in growing older. 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, they would have ended in the horse pond, and I should have had a suit for assault and battery on my hands as well as all the rest."
"How did they respond to this?"
"They made a good deal of noise, some hectoring, some conciliating, carrot and stick, rope's end and soft soap. They did not expect a gentleman to withdraw from his undertakings. It was useless to attempt to do so in any case, as they had a lien upon my property. In my absence the association had been obliged to take up money at an exorbitant rate of interest. They had every right to pledge my credit. Kimber had delegated his full powers to them. Ready money would have been far cheaper than discounting bills, but unfortunately Mrs. Aubrey had not seen fit to produce it. They meant no criticism. Ladies could not be expected to understand business. The only way to proceed was to push on, to satisfy the more pressing creditors, to raise fresh capital and push on. Now that I was back, everything would be easy. They could find fresh capital on the security of my name alone. My signature, a mere formality. If I declined, they would most reluctantly be compelled to take measures to safeguard their own interests."
A pause.
"God knows how I shall come out of it," he said. "It looks precious like a lee shore to me."
They changed horses at Petersfield, and as the chaise ran clear of the town, Jack said,
"Lord Stephen, I'm so glad Sophie clapped down when she did. The moment she found Kimber was playing fast and loose, she wrote and told him to stop. And from that moment on she refused to sign anything or to give him any money. And when things grew worse, she laid up the carriage, sold off the horses, and told the servants to look about for new places. All but Dre and Woolwich, who have only one sound leg between them. There is still a good deal in the stocks and at Hawes, if only I can contrive to hang on to it. I believe she has a better head for business than you or I. She was against it from the start, you know. Against that fellow Kimber and his whole goddamn scheme."
Stephen might have observed that he too had been against the whole goddamn scheme from the start, that it had seemed to him a typical snare laid for Jack ashore, or at least for the richer kind of officer. But he did not, and Jack went on,
"A good woman is a... There is something in the Bible I don't quite recall, that it hits the nail on the head, as you might put it."
"I am sure you are right," said Stephen. "Tell me, what happened to Killick's wife, the one he bought in the market with a halter round her neck when we were last in England?"
"Oh," said Jack, laughing, "she went off again with her first husband within a few days of our sailing. It appears they make quite a practice of it, going from market to market along the coast. And when Sophie's mother searched her box, she found all poor Killick's property as well as a couple of our silver plates. I should never have allowed the rummaging if I'd been at home, but I'm just as pleased now. I value those plates."
"Mrs. Williams is now exercising her ministry in Ulster, I believe."
"Yes, thank God. She is looking after Francis while she has her baby. It would have been the very devil if she'd been here while Sophie was cutting down the establishment."
"I am afraid it has deprived her of a very real enjoyment," said Stephen, remembering Mrs. Williams's delight in economy, her triumphant saving of a candle end, and her profound pound foolishness. Jack began,
"Mrs. Williams,"
in a strong voice, thought better of whatever he had been going to say, coughed, felt in the pocket of the chaise for a parcel wrapped in a napkin, and said,
"Have one of these. Sophie made them, and I had to promise they should all be eight. She will never be happy until I am as fat as the Durham ox."
They finished the sandwiches a little after Guildford, when dusk was falling, and Jack, having shaken the napkin out of the window, folded it up and said,
"I believe I shall take a cork."
He composed himself in his corner, his chin dropped onto his chest, and as quickly, as definitively, as the setting of the tropical sun, he went to sleep. It was a gift common to most seamen, the result of many, many years of keeping watch, and Stephen, an insomniac, watched him enviously. The hedges sped by, growing dimmer. Cottages, haystacks, villages. The Portsmouth coach, its lights already blazing, and the guard tooting away on his horn. Jack slept on. He slept even through the next change of horses, and it was only when they were crossing Putney Heath that he sat up and said,
"What is a garnishee?"
"A garnishee?" said Stephen, and considered for a while. "Sure, it is a legal term. But what it signifies, I cannot tell. I know nothing of the law, except that whenever a plain man comes into contact with it, he is likely to suffer extremely in his purse and spirit, however sound his cause. So I do conjure you, my dear, to take the very best advice you can, and at once. This is no time for half measures, no time for your provincial lawyers. You must fee the finest talent in London. You must armour yourself with the highly trained intelligence of an eminent counsellor, accustomed to meeting these scoundrels on their own devious ground, another Grotius, a second Pufendorf."
"Yes, but where am I to find my second Pufendorf?"
"Where indeed? But at least I know a discreet, intelligent person in town, a gentleman perfectly conversant with the reputation of those most in view, perfectly qualified to point out the shrewdest legal talent. Will I ask him?"
"That will be very kind, Stephen, if it don't put you out."
It did not put Stephen out by so much as a yard. His whole purpose in going to London was to carry the spoils of Boston to his chief, Sir Joseph Blaine, the discreet, intelligent person to whom he had referred. These spoils, these papers, he carried with him, wrapped in sailcloth. And since he had once left secret documents in a hackney coach, he now took a chair, where he was obliged to hold the packet on his knee. It had cost him pains enough. The chairmen carried him through the drizzle and the sparse, umbrellaed streets, past several transparencies of the Victory, already much the worse for wear, though their guttering lights still showed a recognisable pair of ships, labelled Shannon and Chesapeake, in enormous letters, together with as much in the way of wit or verse as space or invention would allow. They stopped at a discreet small house behind Shepherd Market. The leader thundered on the door, and there was Sir Joseph himself, holding a candle. "My dear Maturin," he cried, looking attentively at the packet as he brought Stephen into the hall, "this is a delightful surprise. Welcome home at last." They walked upstairs to the library, a thoroughly comfortable bachelor's room, Turkey carpet, very easy chairs, a great many handsomely bound books, mostly on entomology, some unusually accomplished erotic pictures and bronzes, a fire winking in the brass fender, a green-shaded lamp.
"I must beg your pardon for asking to come here, sir," said Stephen, "but I have been away so long that I no longer know how things stand at the Admiralty. I collected that there had been changes, so I thought it better there should be no possibility of misunderstanding or delay."
"Not at all, not at all. Nothing could give me more pleasure. I ordered a fire as soon as ever your message came through. You always were a chilly immortal. Pray pull your chair a little closer. No, I do assure you I take it most friendly. And, as you say, there have been changes at the Admiralty, for Warren is no longer with us, but that you knew before the Leopard sailed. Oh, what a stroke that was, Maturin. My congratulations did reach you at last, I believe."
"In Java itself. You were too kind entirely."
"There, for once, we must disagree. It was the completest thing in my experience, a model of its kind. And then Admiral Sievright has gone, together with some others. But then again, there are half a dozen new faces, very able young men, some of them, and we have a new second secretary, Mr. Ray, from the Treasury, or more precisely, an acting second secretary, though I have little doubt he will be confirmed unless poor Barrow makes a most unexpected recovery. He is a man with a wonderful grasp of detail and a very great deal of energy. I wish I had half as much. He works harder than any of us, and yet he finds time to lead a very active social life. I never go anywhere without I see him. Perhaps you have met Mr. Ray. Mr. Edmund Ray." Stephen had met Mr. Ray, but on a somewhat unfortunate occasion, when Jack Aubrey had accused the gentleman, in only very slightly veiled terms, of cheating at cards. Ray had not seen fit to ask for the usual explanation. Perhaps he considered the veil sufficiently obscure, and with Jack's long absence the affair had blown over. But this scarcely seemed the time to elaborate on the acquaintance, particularly as Stephen was aware that Sir Joseph had not the slightest interest in the matter. His bright, knowing eye was fixed upon the sailcloth parcel.
"These I acquired in Boston," said Stephen, unwrapping it at last. "On the first sheet you will find a succinct account of the manner in which they came into my possession, and on the next a summary of their contents. Most are only of local significance, and Major Beck in Halifax has already dealt with them. But I flatter myself that some are of wider and more general importance."
Sir Joseph put on his spectacles and sat at the library table, the lamp by his side.
"My God!" he cried after a moment. "These are Johnson's private papers."
"Just so," said Stephen.
He got up and stood with his back to the fire, his coat-tails hitched forward so that his meagre hams should grow really warm, and he contemplated Sir Joseph, intent on his reading in that silent room, wholly concentrated in that disk of light, tearing the heart out of the matter with an almost shocking eagerness. There was not a sound but the turning of sheets, and an occasional low exclamation.
"Ah, the dog! The cunning dog!"
After a while, Stephen turned to the bookshelves. Malpighi, Swammerdam, Ray, Réaumur, Brisson, the most recent Frenchmen, including the elder Cuvier's latest essay, which he had not yet seen. He read the first chapters, sitting on the arm of his chair, and then moved over to Sir Joseph's cabinet to find the insect in question. Drawer after drawer filled with creatures, lovingly killed, pinned down, and labelled. In the second drawer he saw that great rarity, a true gynandromorph, a clouded yellow, male one side, female the other, and beneath its scientific name he read, "The gift of my esteemed friend, Dr. P.H." Those were the letters he had been using for departmental communications at the time he gave Blaine the butterfly. Sir Joseph was always prepared for the unexpected, and no one but himself could decipher the initials appended to so many of the specimens throughout the great collection, particularly to the more exotic beetles, some of which Stephen recognized as coming from Java, the Celebes, India, Ceylon, and Arabia Felix, no doubt the gift of far-flung agents, all as nameless to him as he was to them. He found his insect, an ill-looking weevil, and returned to the text, tipping the book and the case so that they came within the rim of light. Sir Joseph read on. Stephen was deep in Cuvier's argument. It was persuasive, it was elegantly put, yet somewhere there was a fallacy. He turned back 2 pages, keeping his finger on the weevil's rostrum, but the references to the illustration were obscure. The error might perhaps have become evident if he had not had a long day's travelling, and if part of his mind was not so taken up with Diana. It was an ill-regulated mind, and if it were not carefully watched, it would mourn Diana's death, or at least the death of his infinitely cherished myth, a dark, bitter, monotonous grieving. Yet the mourning was not pure. It no longer invaded him entirely, perhaps because often and often, in the most unexpected ways, the old myth and the new reality tended to coincide. Perhaps, he reflected, this had a certain relationship to marriage. They had been together a very long time, and although they might essentially be strangers, they were inextricably entwined. Diana Villiers. He stared into the declining fire, and Cuvier receded, faded, became infinitely remote. Sir Joseph gave a sigh, bringing Stephen back into that pleasant room. He put the papers back into their folder and came round the table. "Dear Maturin," he said, shaking him by the hand, "I am at a loss. I used all my superlatives when I wrote to you about the leopard coup, and now I can only say them over again. You have done magnificently, sir, magnificently. Yet I shudder, yes, upon my word, I literally shudder when I think of the risks you ran to bring these papers away." His praise ran on, handsome, generous, and sincere. And then, "You do not in principle object to suppers, my dear sir? There is a bottle I should like to share to celebrate your return. A bottle, in fact, nata mecum consule buteo, the last I possess. How I wish it may have survived." It had survived. A noble port. And as they drank it after their buttered eggs and deviled bones and Stilton cheese, Sir Joseph tapped the folder. "Mr. Johnson must be an unusually interesting man," he observed. "These records show his progress from the gifted amateur to the professional. A most strikingly rapid progress, as though he and his colleagues had condensed generations of experience into a few years. To be sure, he was overreached by the Frenchmen, but that might happen to anyone, and his network in Canada does him great credit. What kind of a man is he?" "He is fairly young, and he has a superabundance of mental energy and animal spirits. I think he would be called a good-looking man. Certainly he has easy, genteel, insinuating manners. And although, in fact, I believe that love of power is by far and away his strongest characteristic, he does not present anything of the unamiable outward appearance of an ambitious, dominating, masterful creature. He was born to a very considerable fortune, and he has strong natural parts. I do not pretend to say that there is a necessary relation of cause and effect, but he is exceedingly impatient of contradiction or of anything that thwarts him, and since he is a clever, remarkably tenacious and determined man, and one who can draw on great private wealth when secret funds are inadequate or delayed, he is a dangerous opponent. I am persuaded, for example, that he hired two privateers to waylay our packet. I am persuaded that he offered them a very great reward for seizing us. They lay in the path of the sloop bearing the original dispatches, yet let it pass. Yet they pursued us with an inveteracy that can only be explained by the prospect of enormous gain. It is true that in this case Johnson had an unusually powerful motive." "Yes," said Sir Joseph. But whether he meant that he thoroughly understood Johnson's motive, or whether it was no more than an ordinary civil assent, there was no telling. He filled their glasses, gazed at the candle through his wine, chuckled, and said, "Such a coup, by God! Such a coup!" "It was a lucky stroke," said Stephen, "that I will not deny. And although it was forced upon me by circumstances rather than by any real merit of my own, I am not sorry to finish my career with a success, however fortuitous."
"Finish, Maturin?" cried Sir Joseph in a startled voice. "What can you mean by that?"
Sir Joseph possessed all the qualities required to make an excellent chief of intelligence, but he had never had much sense of fun at any time, and his dismal, anxious trade has smothered what little there was in his original composition. He did not perceive that Stephen spoke with a certain levity, yielding to the temptation of rounding out a phrase, and he went on with great earnestness,
"Maturin, Maturin, how can you be so weak? In your remote exile you have been reading our bulletins and communiques, intended for neutral and above all for Russian opinion, and you have come to the conclusion that the war is virtually over, that because Wellington has overrun so much of Spain that Napoleon is defeated, and that because we hold your beloved Catalonia your occupation is gone. But I must tell you that Spain, particularly a Mediterranean Spain and Catalonia, is very lightly held, a few battalions of invalids and Portuguese, and a French movement there, an incursion from the Roussillon behind Wellington's right flank would cut his immensely extended lines of communication. No, no, even there the situation is perilous to a degree, to say nothing of the north. Wellington has to be supplied by sea. Command of the sea is the absolutely crucial point. And consider our Channel squadron alone. Here is Lord Keith's latest statement. The enemy has 12 sail of the line besides the Jemappes in perfect readiness for sea and 15 frigates, 15, Maturin, besides smaller vessels. And the force at present under my orders numbers 14 of the line, 8 frigates, 6 sloops, 2 gun brigs, 1 schooner, and 2 hired cutters, 11 either in port or on their way to refit. A third of them useless. The French all ready for action. And it is the same with all the other squadrons. As you see, a successful sortie by the French would leave Wellington hanging in the air, and completely change the face of the war. Even as it is, we have continual complaints from him about naval protection and supplies. No, no, I do assure you, Maturin, the war is in its most dangerous stage. We are at our last throw. We have no reserves left. And if Napoleon achieves a victory by land or sea, I doubt we can ever recover it. You have been away a great while, and perhaps you cannot fully appreciate the immense decline in this country's resources since you left. Taxes are as high as they can possibly be, perhaps even higher, and yet the money does not come in. We can scarcely fit out the fleet. Government's credit is very low. You could paper your room with treasury bills, the discount on them is so shockingly great. Trade is almost at a standstill. Gold is not to be had, paper money everywhere, and the city is deeply depressed. The city is morose, Maturin. Morose! Stephen was indifferent to the city's mood, but otherwise he abounded in Sir Joseph's sense. He did not possess his chief's wealth of immediate, detailed information, but he had helped in the drawing up of too many fallacious documents to have been deceived by much of what he had read, and he knew very well that the situation was critical, that the alliance against Bonaparte was fragile in the extreme, and that with both sides exhausted, a single victory, well followed up on the part of the French, might mean a wholly disastrous end to the war and the establishment of tyranny for generations to come. Sir Joseph was preaching to the converted, and Stephen regretted his remark. He regretted it all the more because, with the years, Sir Joseph's tendency to prolixity had grown. He was being prolix now, about the stock exchange. "I do not suppose," he said, "there are many things that men think about with such deep, careful, zealous attention as money, and the stock exchange is an infallible index of their thoughts, the collective thoughts of a large number of intelligent, informed men who have a great deal to lose and win. Even this heaven-sent victory of yours and Wellington's at Vittoria have scarcely moved the city to anything more than bonfires and illuminations and patriotic addresses. These gentlemen know that we cannot go on alone much longer, and at the first stroke of ill fortune our allies will desert us, as they have so often deserted us before. No, sir, if I were half as sanguine about Napoleon's downfall as you, I should go down into the city tomorrow and make my fortune. How would you do that, for all love? Why, I should buy government stock, India stock, and any sound commercial shares whose value depends on foreign trade. I should buy them at their present dirt-cheap rate, and then as soon as Bonaparte was knocked on the head or peace was declared, I should sell them at a perfectly enormous profit. Perfectly enormous, my dear sir. Any man with foreknowledge could do the same. Any man who could command a considerable sum, or whose credit was good for a considerable sum, could make his fortune. It would be much like betting on a horse race if you knew the winner in advance. That is how fortunes are made on the stock exchange, although I must confess that the issues concerned are rarely so great.
"You astonish me," said Stephen. "I know nothing of these things."
"I never supposed you did," said Sir Joseph, smiling at him affectionately. "Allow me to pour you a little wine." "But, however," he went on, "I shall not make my fortune, alas, for the very good reason that I thoroughly agree with the gentlemen in the city. I believe they are perfectly right. Napoleon is still a very great commander, and although he got into a sad pickle in Moscow, he has astonishing powers of recovery. He has just shown us what he can do at Lützen. Berlin is in the greatest peril at this moment. I dread another of his sudden, brilliant strokes, dividing the Allies and destroying them piecemeal. He has done it again and again, and he still has something like 250,000 men in Germany, all living off the country, and fresh divisions are being trained in France. And in any case, his fleet is quite untouched. There they lie, in the Scheldt, and in Brest, and Toulon.
Do you know, Maturin, that there are no less than 21 ships of the line and 10 heavy frigates in Toulon alone? Beautiful, well-equipped, well-manned ships that we try to blockade with old, worn-out squadrons, crazy with keeping the sea in all weathers right round the year. No, no, Maturin, take the stock exchange for your barometer, and rest assured that there is a great deal of work for us to do before Boney is brought down.
Then let us drink to his ultimate confusion, said Stephen.
Confusion to Boney, said Blaine, savouring his port.